Fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip. Few issues have galvanized discussions in Wisconsin more than homelessness and affordable housing, as thousands of residents struggle to find suitable housing within their means. What once was considered an urban problem is now stretching into rural communities as well, prompted by stagnant wages and the rising cost of home rental and ownership. Studies show that families start to struggle meeting their basic needs when their housing costs exceed 30% of their monthly income. And whether they own or rent, nearly one of every four households in the state fit that category. Community leaders are just now beginning to understand the scope of the challenges involved, and they're working to address them in a variety of ways. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shireen Seward, and we welcome listeners to the West Side. Rising housing costs, higher rent, evictions, declining home ownership rates, and a growing number of rent-burdened households all play a role in the state's critical shortage of affordable housing. Those who struggle often work multiple jobs just to get by and face impossible decisions as they try to balance work with family obligations. Families that need help paying rent often find insurmountable challenges, ranging from long waiting lists for housing assistance, a shortage of transitional housing, and a complicated matrix of programs to navigate. And affordability issues are not limited to the lowest income households. Families above the poverty line are struggling as well, as homes and apartments continue to grow more expensive over time. The pressure is building to address the shortage, something that community leaders say will take long-term commitments in both the public and private sectors. Today, we're joined by three guests to help us better understand this complex issue and discuss some potential solutions to the housing crisis affecting thousands of residents in central and western Wisconsin. Rob Summerfield, the Republican state representative from Bloomer, is chair of the state's Committee on Housing and Real Estate. Representative has been working on legislation to address the housing shortages in local communities and has also been working in a private-public partnership with WEDA, the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority, to design and implement solutions to the problem as well. Rob, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
Tom Killian is a Wausau City Council alderman. He represents one of the most economically depressed areas of the city with a large share of low-income residents. Tom, who sits on the city's Economic Development Committee, is a vocal advocate for affordable housing and is proposing new and unique solutions to the housing crisis in the area. Tom, welcome to Route 51.
Thank you for having me.
Our third guest today is Susan Wolfgram. She is co-chair of the Jonah Affordable Housing Task Force. It's a grassroots social justice group. Susan also sits on the Plan Commission in Eau Claire. Susan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Shireen.
Listeners with questions for our guests are welcome to join in by calling us at 800-780-9742 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Rob, I'd like to start by asking you about the Committee on Housing and Real Estate. What exactly does that committee do, and how did you get involved in that?
Yeah, to start off, the committee, you know, basically what it sounds like, housing and real estate. You know, there's bills that go on with zoning issues, private roads bill, which I did, workforce housing, other housing packet or bills that are out there gets referred to the committee. So that's kind of what the committee looks for. This last month, the committee has really been dedicated on addressing this issue, the workforce issue. We had a package of bills that came out last month, went through them, amended them, worked through the process, and, you know, got them passed in the assembly. So this is, you know, I see as a major issue. That's why I got involved when I first got elected in 2016. You know, I was talking to area businesses, families, schools, you know, everything in my area. And they said, you know, we do need more housing. You know, it wasn't great back then, but it's nothing like the level it is today. So I think as policymakers on the statewide, we have to figure out, you know, what tools we can give developers, communities, everybody involved in this process to be able to help address this issue, because workforce housing is one of those issues that not one bill will fix this, one idea. It has to be a compilation of many different ideas. That's why I'm excited to be chairman of that and hopefully working with numerous people throughout the state to hopefully address this issue.
And I'll ask you about some specifics a little bit later on about those bills. But Susan, I'd like to hear about Jonah. What is it? And how did you get involved in Jonah?
So Jonah is a faith-based social justice grassroots group, and we've been at the forefront of bringing affordable housing to a top city priority since 2000. and 18. We center impacted communities in our work and collaborate with the city and county on many housing related issues. And Eau Claire has come a long way in terms of very innovative solutions to affordable housing. If you have the time, I just would like to comment on the difference between the definition between affordable housing and workforce housing, following up on what Rob said. Would that be an appropriate time right now?
Sure, go right
ahead.
Okay. You bet, Susan.
Okay, so I very much agree with Rob in terms of the spirit of affordable housing being a crisis in our entire country, much less our state. But workforce housing is a term that has been used now in place of affordable housing in recent years to support policies and strategies for moderate and middle income households. Now that's between 60 and 120% of the county median income. So not to get in the weeds, but for Eau Claire County, the county median income is around $60,000 a year. But what the problem with that, and where I push back and our task force pushes back, is that this redefinition of affordable housing in terms of the workforce leaves behind the significant working population that falls below this income threshold. So just quickly, in Eau Claire, we have built since 2018, or we're in the process of building around 1,000 units of workforce housing in the area. But this is the point I want to make. 37%, and it's more since COVID, of our workforce earns less than $30,000 per year, which is 50% of the county median income. So these are the folks now that are left behind within that definition, and they are in the 25 lowest paid occupations, which are generally our service workers. So this is the point that I wanted to make about that. Thank you.
Sure, absolutely. And Tom, I'd like to turn to you. Before you were elected to the city council, you were well known as an advocate for environmental cleanup in the Wausau area, and then you decided to run for office. How did you become aware of the housing affordability challenges in your neighborhood? And do you feel like it's limited to low-income residents, or are people in the higher-income households also limited?
Sure. Well, you know, in the Thomas Street neighborhood, for example, what we saw, and I think this was laid bare by a road development and economic development project here, is there was going to be the potential use of eminent domain for that project if certain people would not leave voluntarily. So the risk and outcome was displacement of residents from their home and from the neighborhoods. Some of these individuals and families had been here for 40 years or more. So what we saw through this development process was kind of the expulsion of low and middle income residents from the neighborhood. Now, later on, this we saw some problems with some infill development there that developed housing that was way beyond really the reach of people, existing residents in the neighborhood. So while people had been maybe paying $600 a month for a mortgage here, we were seeing new developments being built at about $1,200 to $1,400 a month to rent. So simply unaffordable and unattainable. So that was kind of the sequence of events here. But I think the question about what income brackets do we see this at, I think it's a very good one, because yes, there is the missing middle, but I think there's also the missing low. And the only thing that may be present is the oversubsidized high. And so I think it's important to recognize the dramatic impact that COVID has had on housing and costs, you know, through shortage of inventory on the market, shortage of labor, and shortage of supplies, which may have increased costs. But make no mistake, I think this underproduction of housing has been taking place for a very long time, and we can trace it to poor government policy, gentrification, and representation being out of touch with the day-to-day reality reality of people's lives. So I think this has been a long time coming, and COVID has simply poured gasoline on the fire.
So, Rob, how is the housing situation tied to workforce development? And Rob, there you go.
This goes.
That's goes okay.
Better.
Yeah.
With this, with the, you know, workforce, you know, I use our Triple Valley area. We have numerous jobs, numerous companies that are looking. They just had a job fair last Friday. That we have the jobs, you know, in our area. What talking to employers, it's the challenges of people coming in and finding a place to live. I mean, I know in, you know, pretty much most of my area, especially in Bloomer, you put your house up for sale and it's, if you have a reasonable price or even a touch high, 24 hours, it's gone. I mean, there is no stock, no ever. So this is, you know, one of the pieces to help grow our region and our economy and our schools and cities and everything that goes around that into it, that if you can get people come in here working and living, you know, it continues the benefits for future generations.
And Susan, I want to ask you too, at what point does housing become unaffordable for people? We've heard kind of this 30% figure. Is that accurate? At what point are families having to make tough decisions on whether they pay their rent or whether they pay their medical bills, for example?
Well, I think we all know that affordable housing is on a spectrum from our unhoused neighbors to middle-class families that are finding it hard now to be able to purchase a home. But our most significant and urgent need are those in that very low-income category. And what we've identified is anyone really that's under the 80% of your county median income is considered low-income. But our most urgent need are for those that are making 50% or less that Tom referenced as well. And again, 40% of our workforce in Eau Claire are at that 50% county median income or less. Developers are partners with us. Developers are not the problem. We partner with developers. We meet with them. Most of them want to be able to meet this need in some way. We know that we don't have any more inclusionary zoning. And so one thing that we're doing in Eau Claire to help developers be able to meet the need is that we have an affordable housing fund now to be able to help with the gap financing that they need in order to be able to contribute to affordable housing. That's just one thing that we're doing. And the other thing is that it doesn't matter how many vouchers you have. If you do not have landlords or property managers that are willing to rent to people, many of whom have high rental barriers, such as eviction histories, criminal histories, if you don't have landlords willing to rent, then the vouchers mean nothing. And so we have a very low vacancy rate in Eau Claire that's most likely duplicated across the state and across the country. So another thing that we're doing just quickly is we have started a city landlord support program that has a tenant education component and a risk mitigation component for property managers.
And how can we balance addressing the needs of lower income, middle income, and workforce housing? I mean, what are your thoughts on that, Susan?
I think that we need additional legislation, and we're making asks about that, similar to the legislation that Rob is proposing for those that are really making between 80 and 120% of the county median income. That's generally the definition of workforce housing. But we need additional intentional legislation to address the needs of those making below 80% and particularly targeting those at 50%.
You're listening to Susan Wolfgram, Tom Killian, and State Representative Rob Summerfield, our guests today on Route 51 as we continue this discussion on the affordable housing crunch that's impacting residents throughout central and western Wisconsin. When we return, we'll talk about the differences between revitalization and gentrification and some potential solutions to the problem as well. Your comments are welcome. Join us by calling 800-780-9742 or email ideas@wpr.org. Once again, extending a warm welcome to listeners from the West Side, I'm Shireen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shireen Seward, welcoming listeners from the West Side. Tom Killian, Rob Summerfield, and Susan Wolfgram are our guests today to discuss the factors impacting the ongoing housing shortage and what can be done to address the issue. What would you like to know? Email us at ideas@wpr.org or join us by phone at 800-780-9742. Tom, I'm going to touch on gentrification and revitalization in just a bit, but I want to hear your thoughts on higher priced housing. You brought this up just a few minutes ago, and I know that at least a half a dozen high-end apartment complexes have been either recently built or are in the planning stages in Wausau. And some community leaders say that those higher end apartments are really necessary to attract a robust workforce. What do you say to that?
Sure. Great question, Shireen. And you're right that there have been high end developments constructed in the recent past, and more are planned in the downtown and riverfront area. I think it relates to also this theory that the kind of musical chairs or musical housing theory that as these developments are built, there's going to be this climb up the ladder for everyone. So as some move to different homes or higher priced homes, then those middle priced homes will then be vacant and occupied by someone else. Well, I think that musical chairs approach, which kind of a neoliberal approach that the marketplace is going to sort itself out, that was always fallacious, but we can certainly see that currently it does not work statistically. So one reason we're seeing higher homes in the market is due to the lack of inventory. So obviously this exchange is not occurring. That's a very important aspect. Secondly, I think that we have to look at opportunity cost. So there's been a philosophy that subsidizing these higher end developments does not harm affordable housing, but the opportunity cost of subsidies, I think, contradicts that. And we cannot place funds and subsidies into one project without taking it away from another. So I have been very critical of this approach in town of putting so many subsidies and funds into higher end development.
Rob, what are your thoughts on those higher end apartments that are often, at least in the Wausau area, subsidized by taxpayer dollars? Is there an upside to that?
I mean, I think, higher end also has to be part of the whole packages. I mean, I think we're getting, in this conversation, develop workforce, but we also look at high end and actually low income, too, because to get, quality or people to move to our area, especially probably the millennial generation, maybe some of the Gen Zers, they have this housing, so that helps, with the taxes, et cetera. Then, also work on the workforce side, then also low income. I mean, in my first term, I did pass a bill for increasing low income housing tax credits that have been very successful. So I think instead of us, picking on one level or the other, I think we can do all of it. But it does take smart planning, especially on the local city, the local areas, municipalities know what they're looking for. And that's where I think we need to encourage much development as possible.
Let's talk a little bit about the factors that led to this in the first place. Susan, let's start with you. How did we get here?
Well, I think what I mentioned before about developer costs, that's the primary one right now that's hindering affordable housing in Eau Claire. And that's where developer incentives are going to be so important in order to be able to integrate affordable units within developments. We have developers that want to meet our community need of affordable housing, but they just don't know how to do it. So again, working with our city in terms of providing some gap financing for them, understanding the difference again, which you mentioned between gentrification and revitalization, and really pushing the narrative of revitalization. So we know that gentrification really focuses on increased property valuation, and business growth without any intentional plans to sustain affordable housing in the area. And that leads, as Tom was saying, to displacement of residents. We are pushing the narrative and working with developers to preserve the neighborhood culture as well as diversify incomes without displacement of both and. And that is really catching on in our city.
And Tom, you've been outspoken about gentrification efforts in Wausau, but supportive of revitalization projects. Do you think that revitalization is really part of the solution that we have to be looking toward?
Well, certainly, I think investment and reinvestment in our working and middle class neighborhoods is critical. And I think that's what we could put under the umbrella of revitalization. As Susan mentioned, this is supporting an existing community and the residents there, making improvements for residents who already reside in that area. It's not just about expelling those current residents and bringing in perhaps more affluent imports into the neighborhood. So yes, I think, and it goes to the core of our discussion today on all aspects, I think the funds must go to the most needed areas. And often those are our working class and middle class neighborhoods.
Rob, I have to wonder, there's so much talk about the supply chain right now. We see supply chain issues everywhere, from restaurants to the construction industry. Mm-hmm. So how much of the cost of building materials and supply chain issues factored into the housing situation that we're now seeing?
I mean, I think that is one of the biggest issues. Luckily, they haven't kept on going up. We're still at highs, for the past year and a half, especially that, when you add, talking to construction companies, that it's added probably 20%, on the cost of everything. So that even makes our problem even more of a challenge when we're starting off at a high level, or we were already at a higher level. Then you put another 20% on it, it just makes the problem even more and more of an issue. And, hopefully, I've been reading, seeing markets in the next 6 months to a year, construction costs should be dropping. But how much is it going to drop? Is it going to go back to what it was a year and a half ago? Or is it just going to take a 5% drop? And this is the new normal. And, that's truly one of the big issues that we are dealing with on no matter what level we're talking about. It's when your costs to build are that high, it's a major issue.
That's interesting. Tom, we'll recall not too long ago, there was a request for proposals put out in Wausau for developing a remnant parcel that was left over from a construction project. And the only response that came in was for houses that were, $250,000?
Around that price point, yes.
And Tom, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that the builders said, we can't build a house for less than that. What do you think would be a solution to help those builders and developers get the job done?
Sure. And I will address that in right now, the immediate future, and to some degree what Rob mentioned about kind of in this new normal COVID impacted period, what can we do? And I think right now there are funds on the table that are novel funds, and we're talking about massive levels of funding from ARPA and neighborhood investment program funds. And what we're seeing now in Wausau just in the last 72 hours is that it looks like these are really kind of being bastardized in a way and applied to high-end development and in a way that actually excludes the people that they're supposed to be helping. So we should be using those funds to contribute to these much needed projects for low income housing, affordable middle housing. But instead, I've just learned that the city of Wausau wants to put $10.5 million of neighborhood investment program funds into a fancy pedestrian bridge attached to the Waas Mall development downtown. And certainly it's that opportunity cost. When we're spending those types of funds, COVID-related funds, on affluent development while our own citizens lose their jobs and homes, something is wrong, and that is going to lead to catastrophic economic problems.
Susan, what are your thoughts on that? And I'm curious what you think about the funding that is available. Can that be transformational?
We have been advocating similar to what Tom's been advocating for the ARPA funds, a number of millions of dollars of the ARPA funds to go into our affordable housing fund for what we're calling second chance housing. That's one type for those thousands of folks in our area that have high rental barriers, primarily criminal histories and eviction histories. If you have one eviction, it can change the trajectory of a family's life. And if you have multiple evictions in a community, it destabilizes an entire community. And the other ask that we have are a number of millions of dollars of the ARPA funds to go into the Affordable Housing Fund for intentional housing for those that are making less than 80% of the county median income. But as I've said before, focused on those folks of the greatest need, and that is around 50% of our county median income. So we're trying to be very intentional about that. We do have a city council that is very supportive of these efforts, very progressive in these efforts. So I'm thinking that we are going to have some success there. I was disappointed earlier this year when we were advocating at the budget hearings. I was disappointed to learn that the $50 million grant program that was being put forward to encourage the development of this additional low-cost housing in the state, that was not advanced. And that's really what we need. So I'll stop there.
Rob, what are your thoughts on that? What Susan just said?
Well, I mean, that's part of the budget process. I would have been comfortable with that in there. However, a lot of the discussion was moving that money into the workforce housing part. I think with Tom and Susan mentioned, with the additional all this ARPA for local municipalities, that that's a way to also use the funding into that as an option too, with this one-time federal money. And then the locals can have the controls over it. That's not coming from the state saying, if you're going to do this, you got to do X, Y, and Z. The locals have, they know what they need. Tom knows his community. Susan does too. So.
And Tom, what is the community telling you? What are businesses and residents in Wausau telling you they need the most?
Sure. They are telling me that they need to address these urgent and dire needs that have worsened during COVID. And we're talking about housing for people that may have a roof over their head right now, but housing for those who don't, and homelessness, and also addressing childcare needs. And that also has trickle down economic effects, because it's very hard, I think, for parents to be at their job or workplace if they don't have affordable childcare. So with those monies I just mentioned, the $10.5 million for this pedestrian bridge, citizens are absolutely livid. And I think that's clear online and in news comment sections. And I was surprised to learn yesterday that WEDIC supported the submission of this proposal on the neighborhood investment funds for this pedestrian bridge. And I would say that I think both the city of Wausau and the administration needs to recognize and rectify this problem very quickly, because I do not think the people will tolerate this type of economic approach here.
Rob, what are businesses telling you about their housing needs? What are you hearing?
I mean, that's, hearing that they're like, Rob, we don't have a solution. Hey, this is a silver bullet, but we have to do something. So, that's why the bail packages came out. The idea is we're continuing to hear that, hey, this is how it is. This hasn't happened yet, but it's been floated. Do we look to help employers, give them a tax credit, tax break, something, if they provide X amount of dollars for housing? Or do they do development? So, so this is what I'm trying to figure out with my colleagues down in Madison, both sides of the aisle, especially on what ideas are out there. I think everything, this is kind of cliche, everything's on the table, but everything is on the table with this issue. And I think it's not a one size fits all approach. It's to see what may work. So.
I will say, according to U.S. Census Bureau data, that as of the second quarter of this year, only 37.8% of people younger than 35 own housing. Susan, I don't know. That number surprised me. I'm sure it doesn't surprise you with all the work that you've done. But why do you think home ownership has dropped so significantly in recent years?
Well, as a developer just shared with me last week, that right now the average cost of a new build home in Eau Claire is $350,000. So that, of course, speaks for itself. We have a lot of developers now that are building twin homes, smaller units that are much more accessible. But still, those twin homes are even being built at about $200,000 to $260,000 per twin home. Our affordable housing fund does provide money again to developers for rehabbing older housing in the area as well. We're finding, and I think it's across the country, that rehabbing an older unit, of course, makes it more affordable, and to focus a lot more in that area in neighborhoods to make it affordable instead of focusing always on new builds. And so I'll stop with that.
Well, I wanted to ask you about some more of the barriers to housing that you're hearing about, Susan, because you mentioned some of this before. Why is it that landlords completely balk at renting to lower income residents?
Well, I want to be fair to landlords and property managers because they are also our partners in affordable housing. Most of the landlords and property owners in Eau Claire are the mom and pop owners. And many of them have, quote unquote, taken chances on folks with high rental barriers, and they have been seriously burned. So they come to this hesitancy innocently, I call it. And then you have, as I said earlier, you have a very low vacancy rate. So a landlord does not have to take a chance on someone with a high rental barrier. And that's why landlords need incentives. We held a listening session for landlords earlier this year. It was very, very well attended. The very first thing that they said that they needed was they needed an on-call housing navigator, because they are not social workers. They are not able to respond to the needs of their tenants that have needs 24 hours a day. That's the first thing that they said to need that they needed for early prevention. The second thing they needed was a risk mitigation fund and tenant education. So we started the one-year pilot program this year, the landlord support program, to provide the tenant education and the risk mitigation fund. But we have very low participation of landlords, because even providing that, it still is too much risk for them to be able to participate. So we're continuing, we're having one-to-one discussions with landlords. We're really doing everything we can to figure out how to mitigate this.
You're listening to Route 51 with State Representative Rob Summerfield, Tom Killian, and Susan Wolfgram as we discuss the lack of affordable housing for lower and middle class residents. It's part of an ongoing housing shortage impacting thousands of Wisconsinites. When we return, we'll talk about potential solutions on the horizon and what it could take to ease the housing crunch. Your questions and comments are welcome. Join us at 800-780-9742 or email ideas@WPR.org. Once again, extending a warm welcome to listeners from the West Side, I'm Shireen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shireen Seward, welcoming listeners from the West Side. Susan Wolfgram, Tom Killian, and Rob Summerfield are our guests today as we continue our discussion on the affordable housing crisis and what communities, lawmakers, and organizations are doing to make housing more affordable for residents. What would you like to know? Email us at ideas@wpr.org or join us by phone at 800-780-9742. Tom, we talked a little bit earlier in the program about those housing developments along Thomas Street in Wausau and a developer that wanted to put up homes that were $200,000+. You had an alternative option that you presented, and I'd like you to explain that.
Sure, Shireen. What I brought to the Economic Development Committee early this year in January was I proposed we begin discussing and investigating community land trust possibilities. And I think there are some unique things about community land trusts that work quite well, and they've been surprisingly successful in other areas of the country like Vermont and Texas. And what community land trusts essentially are is, you know, you've got a nonprofit organization that either has or has acquired land, and this can be a public-private endeavor as well, or just private, but the neat thing about it is there's permanence. So once that land is acquired, it's pledged and committed to affordable housing forever, essentially. So it's locked in, and homes are built on the land and sold to individuals and families, but it's more of a 99-year lease. The land is never sold. And what this allows is it allows it to be locked in at an affordable rate. And also, well, the family or individual who owns or has that 99-year lease, they can build some equity for themselves. There's kind of an understanding and formal agreement that some of that is passed on so that there's continued affordability on that property. And I think the beauty of this, and had it been started years ago in Wausau, it would have helped weather this COVID period as things really skyrocket in construction costs and labor and so forth. But it's that protection and permanence. So while I thought that was a real virtue and asset, there was pushback from at least one of my colleagues on the committee who thought, well, what if we want to do something else with that someday? Like, what if we do want high-end development? And well, that may have been seen as a detractor by my colleague. That is exactly the point. It is about protecting people who need protection the most. And often when we're talking about high-end development, I think we're not really looking at community needs and priorities. So we need to keep the wolf from guarding the hen house. And one way you can do that is by having a community land trust.
Susan, what are your thoughts on a community land trust? Is that something that you've heard of or think you might think it might be a solution?
We are talking about that here. I think it is absolutely urgent for all the reasons that Tom gave. Can I go into a couple of other things that we're doing here?
Sure.
So we are doing a lot of revisiting our zoning requirements to allow greater density in appropriate areas. We're talking about infill, relaxing the automobile parking to reduce the cost of developing housing. That is really big wherever appropriate. Encouraging smaller housing units to support smaller families, singles, the downsizing families, our seniors. We have a TIF, TAC increment financing policy. And we're using that housing extension provision to capture an additional year of increment, and that goes into the Affordable Housing Fund. And then using our TIF resources to really strategically advance housing priorities wherever available, and continuing to work with developers on this approach of community benefit, that when you have an ask of the city, what is it that you're going to be giving back to our community in terms of where we need it? And that is a conversation I want to emphasize again that they are engaging in. They want to know what they can do. So they are partners with us and not, you know, and not the quote unquote enemy. I want to make sure that we make that clear. Thank you.
Sure. And Rob, I would like to ask you to expand on some of the solutions that the state legislature has been working on. You mentioned that earlier in the program. What's happening on the state level?
I mean, I'll just kind of hit, kind of the big ones that I think really are probably the most important ones of the packages that really direct. The bill for sales tax exemption on construction materials. That's with the low income up to the workforce up to about 120%. This one will literally reduce costs by 5%, or statewide sales tax 5%. I mean, so that's 5% off the top of construction costs that go away. I think that's one way statewide we can help with the actual cost. Next one, the workforce housing tax credit, which in combination with the low income tax credit, that will allow developers that can crunch the numbers and say, hey, we can do this, charge these rents, in the workforce housing along with, if they want to, with the low income to make the projects work. They talked to a lot of developers. They're crunching the numbers. They want to get this done. But there are some times where costs are prohibitive, so we have to come in and help with that. The third one, which I think Susan mentioned, the rehabbing of homes. I think that's one, I especially look in my area, there's a lot of homes that just need some little more tender love and care. And that's where the younger people hopefully are starting off, that we have a program, Work Through WIDA, to give no interest or low interest loans so they can place the windows, put in a new door, just these little cosmetic things that, help make the house better, in turn increases the value of the house and, gets people the option to say, hey, this house is really, really run down and I can't afford anything else nicer, but we can do these no interest loans, long-term, figure out a system that can help them to reinvest into their building or into their home, so that they're, have a nice place to live.
Susan, I know you wanted to have an opportunity to react to some of this legislation. What do you think about what's being proposed?
Well, I have not. I'm always hesitant to comment until I have read a bill thoroughly. So I have not done that. I have scanned them and I've talked to other people about them. And again, I want to make the point that our workforce also includes those folks that are making less than that 80% of the county median income, and those that are almost 40% in our area that are making 50% or less. These are people that need to be included in that workforce housing definition. And right now in these bills, they are not. The other issue is the control that I have read in these bills that is kept at the state level and not at the local level to meet our own local and unique affordable housing needs. So the mandating, the word that I read repeatedly, required, I'm not sure how much that is going to impact what's going on here, but generally, unless you ask communities what they need and then you propose legislation based on their needs, I think that it could have a very negative effect on our unique communities.
Tom, we've been talking about what can be done on a state level, but what do you think could be done from a local government policy standpoint to really help ease this crisis? What can the local government really do?
Absolutely. Well, the first thing I will say is that many of the things we have been doing, we should cease doing them because they're actually harming the situation. And part of that is, allocating scarce funds and resources to high-end development. Secondly, I think we must immediately act and pursue out-of-the-box turnkey opportunities for high volume affordable housing. One such example is this former university university dormitory so we could have 90 units of affordable housing real quick by pursuing that. We should have done it yesterday. Secondly, with proposals like West Side Battery, we should be quickly opting for the affordable housing. That's 50 units right there between 30% and 60% of the area medium income and income base, so very affordable rates. Then I think we should pursue novel opportunities like community land trusts to further bolster our affordable housing stock. And then lastly, I'd say, and it ties into what Susan mentioned in terms of state influence and interference, is we must immediately begin using these pandemic-related funds like ARPA and neighborhood investment funds in an impactful, legitimate, and more appropriate way. So that starts this Tuesday night by pulling this off the table, this pedestrian bridge. That should be done. It's utterly shameful. And in terms of WEDC and the state, this is my district where this is occurring. WEDC never called me, the older person. They didn't come and say, hey, can we have a tour so we can see the poverty and homelessness in your district? Instead, they circumvented me, and they're throwing public dollars at affluent developers while people lose their homes and live in their cars. This must stop, and we must pursue legitimacy and fundamentally do our jobs, which is protecting and supporting the people we represent.
Rob, Tom talks about legitimacy and ensuring that dollars are going to the right places. What can the state government do to make sure that that happens?
I mean, this is, where, with ARPA funds and everything, Tom's mentioned, they have the local ability to do with their money. When we do, send state money, for instance, in the budget process, that's a reason why we do put guardrails on, because we're sending money there. And, with ARPA, I like to give as much flexibility, but there's times too, if you don't put the guardrails on these proposals, money, they go to places where they're not intended to. And I think that's what, the biggest thing in the state is when we do stuff, especially on the monetary side, make sure the guardrails that, like Tom mentioned, things don't, I don't say abused, but that they go to where they're appropriate supposed to go to.
And Susan, bottom line, what is it going to take to solve this problem?
That's a big question. I think it's going to take all of us recognizing that we are one community, that what impacts one of us impacts all of us. Our low-income folks are our workforce. Folks with rental barriers are our workforce. And we need to work at meeting the needs in terms of equity and inclusion of all of our community members. And I think that many of us are on the road to doing that. We are going to need a lot more state budget support over time. I'm very much in favor of accountability and guardrails, but I do think more asking of communities what it is that they need instead of mandating is the better way to go in that area.
And Tom, how do you convince other local leaders that more affordable housing is a benefit to the community? You mentioned a struggle here earlier in the program about disagreements with your colleagues. How do you get them to see that that it's important and see that connecting housing to a community's economic vitality is a real thing?
Sure. Well, I think, many of my colleagues see this both, I think, qualitatively and quantitatively in the statistics. So I think many of them support it, but it goes to, I think, the city culture and the city's economic culture. And most who have lived here a long time or who grew up here realize there's been a good old boys culture. And often our public dollars have gone to the benefit of a select few. That needs to change. And I think the right outcome starts with the right priorities, and we must change those priorities because I think the wrong priorities have gotten us to the wrong place.
We have about 1 minute left, and Rob, I would like to ask you, in a perfect world, what would need to happen to ensure affordable housing for middle and lower income households? What can the state do?
I mean, I don't have, the silver bullet on this, but I think what we did today, this last hour, what we've been doing down the state to get the conversation and actually get some action, that this is how it gets the locals, get, Jonah, all these other groups, get the state involved, because it's teamwork that's going to need to get this thing accomplished.
And does the federal government have to play a role here?
I mean, if there's programs out there, there's everything with them. And yes, that's also too part of it. Everybody needs to be involved.
Thank you so much for being here today. That's all we have time for on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. So glad to have listeners to the West Side along for the ride today. I'd like to thank our guests, Republican State Representative Rob Summerfield of Bloomer, Susan Wolfgram from Jonah, and Wausau City Council Alderman Tom Killian. Our producers today are Kate Sprenger and Joy Ratchkramer. Our executive producer is Rick Ryer. Rick is also our on-air producer today. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program at WPR.org/Route 51. Next week, we'll take a look at the way communities are determining ways to use COVID relief funding. And in 2 weeks, a lively discussion about cheese. Until then, we're heading out of town.